Hello, and welcome back to another FACT podcast. I'm Dr. Fred Clary, founder of Functional Analysis Chiropractic Technique, a chiropractic technique based on movement and breathing. Well, in today's podcast, we have quite the honor of having Brian Carroll, the strongest squatter of all time, in the interview. He squatted 1,306 pounds. Yes, if you're trying to clear your ears out, I did say 1,306 pounds last October. Brian's been lifting since 1999. He has been a world champion, world record holder. He's actually ranked in the top 10 of three weight classes, the 220s, the 242s, and 275s. He is the creator of the 1020 Life program and approach to lifting. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in the interview. And he is also co-author of a great rehabilitation book called The Gift of Injury. And if you don't own it, whether you're injured or not, you should go out and get a few copies. You'll be blown away by the intelligence and the approach and the discipline. And if you know someone who's injured and they've retired from lifting or sports, get the book for them and have them read it. It may change their life. So without further ado, let's bring on Brian Carroll. Well, we want to welcome Brian Carroll to the podcast. Brian is a long-time powerlifting phenom. He he's in the top 10 totals in the 220, 242, 275. And recently, even with COVID, just squatted 1,306 pounds. He is the creator of the 1020 Life powerlifting program regime, and he's also co-author of The Gift of Injury. Now, this is a book, as a chiropractor, I actually hand out to most of my powerlifting patients as a preventive, and those who are injured so they can make a comeback. So welcome to the program, Brian.
Thank you so much, Fred. I appreciate it. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the nice welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So why don't we fill in a little gaps? We were talking before we start the recording how I was a teenage power lifter. And I know you were too, but I think you were like in the 160s, 165s. Is that right?
So some of the stuff on powerlifting, what's the name of open powerlifting?
Open powerlifting, yeah.
Yeah, some of the stuff they have down for me is not correct. Okay. Now, I did start in 99, but they have some other guy lifting single ply back then. I lifted raw in 99. I lifted single ply in 99. There's probably 10 or 15 meets that I've done that aren't on there, but I got so many things to worry about. That's really not one of them. You know what I mean? So I started lifting about 180 pounds my senior year in high school.
Okay.
Competitive-wise. Okay. Did a raw meet, bench 325 at like 180, and then did a couple more meets in 99 and 2000, and then really got serious about powerlifting in the early 2000s and kind of just took off from there and started doing full meets in the early 2000s and just loved it.
Okay. What made you choose multiply finally as opposed to raw or single ply?
Because at the time, actually, single ply was dying. You know, there was the USPF back then, and they had fallen out or something with the IPF. Something happened back then. So really, everyone either lifted in the gym, or if they competed, they pretty much lifted multiply, because the APF was the big federation back then in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I started lifting APF, WPC, and that happened to be multiply. The first meet that I did, and many meets before that, I would lift in a single ply blast shirt or a single ply marathon deadlift suit. I know that rings a bell.
Yeah.
But the way I looked at it when I started in the late 90s is you lifted like a gym rat. If you didn't compete, you lifted heavy in the gym, and we all knew people like that now and then. But then when you wanted to be a power lifter, you put on the gear and you lifted with other people in gear. And the only people not lifting in gear back then were the guys that either opened raw because they weren't comfortable on the bench shirt, or they deadlifted raw because they didn't really get much out of a deadlift suit. And that's some stuff we could talk about if you want. But
yeah,
You know, you don't, especially conventional deadlifters, don't typically get very much at all out of a deadlift suit. So a lot of people just pulled raw. You even saw it in the WPO the first time around, where guys open up on the bench raw over 500 pounds and then put their shirt on. And then some guys just preferred pulling in a singlet because they just did better and it felt more natural.
Okay. Okay. So just looking through your history and your experience, what led you to the to your program, you know, 1020 Life? Where did that come from? Because did you wake up one night and say, this is it? Or
I watched quite a few videos on YouTube and just stole bits and pieces of everybody's stuff. And then,
okay,
I'm just kidding.
That's what most people do.
I know. And I've actually had lawsuits with people over, okay, over stuff, for my stuff being stolen and not credited properly. But the origin of it was, you know, I had mentors when I was young and I was taught certain principles. So 1020 Life is a book of principles. It's not a program necessarily. Okay. It's a way of programming. So if you were to ask Louis Simmons, like, what are your main principles for programming? He'd probably rattle off 100 different things that may or may not make sense. That may or may not contradict each other. So I have a coherent, clear, concise set of parameters. They're not rules that you can't ever break, but they're parameters.
Okay.
Having phases of training. You can't just go balls to the wall year round. You'll break. I've tried it. You can't do it. The top two lifter for the last 15 years every year, but you've got to pick your times when you're coasting. You got to pick your times when you're pushing ahead. And I think that's one of the flaws with the current or the former WPO outline is, you know, guys that are hitting big weights, girls that are hitting big weights, three meets a year is too much. A qualifier, a semi, a final, it's too much for people at the top level. They'll break. They just can't, they can't peak properly for all three meets. It just doesn't work that way. So 1020 Life is a set of parameters. Like I said, off-season pre-contest, I advocate, I'm sure you heard of, deloads every 3 to 4 mm-hmm. weeks.
Yep.
As a chiropractor, I'm sure you understand with your anatomy and physiology background that tissue needs adequate and proper time to heal. And people think just because they feel fine, I'm good, I can lift heavy. But just because you don't have pain does not mean that your bones, your spine, for instance,
yep,
the micro fractures that you create to make a bone stronger and more resilient, the time to repair has to be respected. So people that do these programs now that squat and deadlift and bench 5 times a week, and I'm not going to deny that you can't get strong that way, but your connective tissue and your bones will not keep up with it no matter what you're taking. And over time, you have a situation. A lot of people have seen the Lane Norton series that I did on YouTube with Dr. McGill.
Yep.
That was a result of a Bulgarian-style training split by a newbie that learned it on the internet and programmed it for Lane, and it destroyed him. Mm-hmm. He was squatting and deadlifting 3 times a week, and that's buffoonish. You cannot do that.
Yeah.
It breaks every rule that anyone with any type of understanding of anatomy and physiology would say, hey, don't do that. It breaks so many rules, but you can get strong doing that. Just like there's a lot of shortcuts to things, but they're not good for the long term. So to get back on what 1020 Life is, it's a sustainable approach for a lifetime of positive momentum in training and in life. And it's a book to help keep you out of trouble with your training.
Well, like I tell my patients all the time, Brian, is you don't grow for the bodybuilders and for the powerlifters. You don't get strong in the gym. You do it when you're recovering outside the gym. And that is really for the newbies and even the intermediate lifters. That is hard for them to understand because they want to go in, take their pre-workout, do their nose torque and go balls to the wall. And they're just injuring themselves. Oh, you know, I did 5 heavy singles last night. And I go, well, how long is that going to take you to recover from? Because if you're not fully recovered on your next, you know, next training session, you're actually breaking down. You're not getting stronger.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting time in lifting. There's a lot more people involved now. Unfortunately, it's diluted it down quite a bit. It's diluted the quality of coaching. It's diluted the quality of content. It's diluted the quality of lifter, too. Which there's good things that come from it. More people are wanting to lift weights. If you looked at Oxygen magazine or Muscle and Fitness 15 or 20 years ago, it was all small, lean guys, lean girls doing curls. Now you have girls on the cover with muscle, with curves, squatting, benching, deadlifting, overhead pressing. So it's gotten the masses over their fear of the barbells, right? So it's helped a lot with that, but it's also created a bunch of goofballs that are have infiltrated our you know, our powerlifting, if you will, and they've done some goofy stuff that, you know, the internet's a weird thing right now, and there's a lot of people, you know, the blind leading the blind right now, and it's not everybody. There's a lot of good stuff out there, but just anyone can claim some certificates and make up some meets they didn't do, and start taking on people if they're a good salesman and con man. And that's one thing I don't like about how much it's grown. It's quite a bit diluted, you know, and the information is so confusing to people too. They hear me say train less, rest more. And then you got some good looking young kid with abs that's saying I squat every day and it's working and they have good genetics and they might be doing it, but it's not a sustainable approach. And that's the overarching theme of 10/20 Life is sustainable training. I've been doing this at a high level for 22 years now, since 1999, June of 99. And there's a reason for that. Have I had injuries? Yes. Have I screwed up? Yes. I screw up all the dang time because I'm experimenting. How do you, why would I test on other people, experiment on other people? I experiment on myself. And then when it works, I take it, keep it. If it doesn't work, I throw it aside. So, I've been doing this for a long time, and the biggest reason, besides having good genetics and, you know, being, you know, cognizant of my body and everything, is just not going hard all the time. People want to post that video on Instagram or show off to their friends and all that stuff, and that doesn't mean anything. I mean, I guess it can help you financially or make you feel better about yourself, but it definitely torpedoes people's meats when they're too worried about putting up a big lift to show off or be competitive on Instagram, but the meet's in 3 weeks and they should be doing what they need to do to get ready for the meet.
Well, I totally agree. We do that similarly with our team. We make sure that they hit their numbers and they're like, oh, you know, I want to max out today. Well, what's your percentage? We do some percentages and it's like, well, it's 85%. Well, you're doing 97, you know, you're a little ahead. Well, I feel good. Well, that's good. You lucked out this week. So go with it, you know, enjoy it, but stick with your program. I agree with you with the goofballs on the internet. I can't tell you how many, and it's good for my career. I have a lot of kids and got to have a mortgage. And, you know, those internet coaches, unfortunately, are hurting a lot of people. So as a chiropractor, I get to see it all the time. You know, how did you get hurt? Well, I was doing this and this. Let me see your routine. Who is this coach? Oh, you don't know who he is? He's famous. No, I've been in powerlifting since 1981. I used to get the magazine when it had a black and white cover. So I've been around. I know who's good. And I know who's good in my area because I train with all of them. So it's like, I don't know who this goofball is. They did one meet, you know, in a closet somewhere and, you know, took whatever they got from bits and pieces and threw it at this person who's naive. And you can't blame the lifter because they're naive. They, this must be right. They haven't been in the game long enough. How do you deal with, say you got some of your clients, how do you deal with some of your newer clients trying to explain to them, you know, that they were in a mess before and this, we got to start over.
I had a guy last week I did a call with. And, he showed me his videos. I do consults with people. Sometimes it's their back. Sometimes they're programming. I'll just say, here's 30 minutes, an hour. I'll help you the best I can. You know, I have information that I've learned from some of the best in the world. Maybe I can help you. Maybe I can't, you know, but most of the time I can do something for him. And he was telling me he was pretty confident in his lifts and his form. And they were terrible. And he has a coach and this and that. And so when I do a call with him in the coming weeks, it's going to be starting from absolute basics because his form is so far gone that it's not going to be him, you know, pulling 450 the way he hurt his back. You know, you probably see a lot of people that come in. Well, what happened? Well, I was squatting. It's always between 275 and 500. They're squatting or deadlifting, and they felt a pop. Their leg went numb. Their glute got on fire. They couldn't get out of bed the next day. It got a little bit better, then it got way worse. I mean, I don't know how many times you probably heard this, but
once a week.
it's the same thing. It's because they have not built a proper foundation, a core of iron. Mm. They don't understand how important it is to lock in the core, have a good form, adapted to your injury history, to your natural leverages. You know, there's a lot of things going on there. You know, you're a taller guy, right? How tall are you?
6'1".
Okay, see, I'm short. I'm 5'9".
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily try to teach you to squat exactly the way I squat.
No.
But we can adapt some things, some similarities there, right? You want to shorten the range of motion as much as possible, keep a tight bar, that kind of stuff. Good knee tracking, but you're not going to look just like me when I'm on squat. So, there's a lot of people that come, and that's a common thing. They break form with about 400 pounds and they hurt their back and they don't understand why. They think their form was good, you know, and then I got to start them over. So some people are more open because they respect my resume more. Other people are just kind of boneheaded and just kind of want to hear what they want to hear. And they'll go to every single expert. They'll say, hey, you know, Joe Schmo, what do you think about this? Brian Carroll, what do you think about this? I don't like your answer. I'm going to go to Timmy over in, you know, Montana. I'm going to talk with him. He's going to give me the answer I want. But there's no magic bullet. There's no secret potion that the top lifters are hiding from you. It isn't that at all. It's smart training, good form, good genetics, a little bit of luck, and a lot of time.
Absolutely. I think time, you hit it on the head. I think time is a great component, because some of these kids, they want to go fast and quick. And I'm like, okay, well, how much are we going to add to my squat? And I said, hopefully 40 or 50 pounds this year. And you've been lifting a few years. We got to clean up your form and maybe more. Is that it? Is that all? That's good. If you stay in sport long enough, you're going to be at 800-900 pounds in 5 to 10 years. What an amazing thing.
Right.
It's not overnight. It's never been overnight. And the ones who are overnight, you've seen them in your career, Brian, they're in for 2-3 years and then they disappear because they get hurt, you know?
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. I just like swallowed my smoothie down the wrong hole or something. A lot of the people beat me. A lot of these guys come up and have beat me.
Yep.
And then they get hurt, and then they're gone. They'll beat me, or they'll come back. They're never the same. I smash them, and they're gone. They'll come up stronger. Like, dang, where did this person come from?
Yeah.
Dang, where did they go? They're here and gone.
Yeah. So, I think patience in that time is very important. Speaking of that, you did have some injuries. I've had injuries, too. I just had 6 screws put in my shoulder, and it took me about a year to come back and start benching heavy again. How did you handle that injury, and what led you to write the book? I think it's fantastic. It has great things, and it's easy for someone to read. What blows my mind is other professionals, other chiros, other orthopedic surgeons are not sharing this information.
Well, there's a lot to that. So let me answer the last part of that first, if you don't mind. So I talked to a pain management doctor that happened to specialize in injections for the spine. And he straight up told me he does not consult his patients because he doesn't get paid to.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So if he's not billing for the injection, referring to surgery or escalating it or what, he doesn't get paid for the downtime, the consult. You know, he doesn't get paid for it, so it's not part of his repertoire. So that's one reason. That's a doctor.
Yeah, that hurts. Yeah.
So, but that's the common theme, though. How many surgeons do you know that have spent 15 minutes with someone, they didn't spend it with me, and say, okay, you're a big guy, you're lifting heavy weights, why don't you work on building your core up a little bit? What are your pain triggers? What hurts you? Okay. let's avoid this for a little while. Take some time off from lifting, go on some walks, stabilize your core, and then come back and see me in 4 or 5 weeks. Here's a card to a great physical therapist that will treat you, but it doesn't work that way. They just get, they refer you to some whoever physical therapist. They might be great, they might be terrible, but unfortunately, physical therapists, like a lot of chiropractors, you have so much to cover that they may not be good at the back. I've met physical therapists that have no clue that they're given goofy stretches for herniated discs and the people never get out of pain. So the reason why I wrote the book was when I got to Dr. McGill in May of 2013, he told me he could help me get out of pain. I had some flattened discs, I had a sacrum fracture, I had a bunch of cumulative damage from a bunch of heavy lifting, sloppy movement from outside the gym, and just cumulative damage from lifting heavy. And just, you know, I fell one time on an obstacle course. There's a lot of things that happened, but it was mainly lifting and poor movement.
Let me stop you there, Brian. For the listeners, what do you mean sloppy movements outside the gym?
So being that I was at the time 285 pounds, we use this analogy for people to try to understand. So here I go. So being 285 pounds and being a guy that power lifts, I'm likened to an oak tree. An oak tree, stiff, strong, if it's treated correctly, all right? Then we have a willow branch. Think of a willow branch as a gymnast. They're flexible, they're bendable. The collagen of the annulus is very flexible. They can move. But if you try to load a willow branch, it's got nothing. It's like trying to put a yogi instructor under a squat bar with 200 pounds on there. They won't, those flatten out. They got nothing.
Kill them.
It'll kill them. But an oak tree strong when you load it properly and it's stiff, but in a hurricane, the willow branch is going to blow around fine. The oak tree's going to snap in half. So I was an oak tree walking around bending all the time, asking too much of my body. You've got to adapt it to the demands of your sport. Mine being, I needed a tough annulus, which is the disc, the ring around the disc. You want that tough and not bend. You know, you don't want to be flexible and bendable because that can lead to a disc bulge. But a gymnast can be flexible because the collagen's, you know, it doesn't need to be resilient from a loading standpoint. So I was not treating my body right. I was bending, I was moving sloppy. I wasn't moving like a professional, especially someone with a back history. You want to avoid your pain triggers. So instead of moving with my hips, I would be lazy and pick up with my back and hinge and bend, flexion being one of my pain triggers. I'd be causing my pain over and over and then wonder why flexion hurt me all the time. So Dr. McGill figured all this out for me, explained it to me in a way I can understand. And he basically told me that I was done lifting and that he could probably get me out of pain when I'm done lifting. And, you know, I've damaged my body so bad, he just doesn't think I have anything left and I shouldn't. And if I were his son, he would urge me to retire. So I, of course, looked at my wife and said, well, you said you can get me out of pain. And if that's true, you know, I'm going to lift again. And he said, okay, well, first things first, let's get you out of pain. And who knows, maybe you're right. Maybe we end up writing a book about your comeback. And I held him to it when I got back and got injury free. Or pain-free, I should say, and rebuilt. Stu helped me get pain-free. We worked together on building me back, and I learned stuff, he learned stuff. Then we put it in a book and released it in October 2017.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fantastic text. I love how you go through some basics, like even watching how you sit or bend down to pick up a sock from the floor. That is amazing. When I talk to my patients about that, they, what do you mean? And it's all about, you know, good mechanics all the time, because I know the biggest injuries I've got, you know, may not have been at the gym, you know, moving a mattress for a friend. You know what I mean? You get hurt outside the gym.
Yeah. Did you back in the day, I'm sure you read Elite FTS, right?
Yeah.
So I remember one time I messed with Spud about this, but I remember one time Spud was carrying something in his front yard and he fell and landed right on his arm and tore his tricep off the bone right after he'd rehabbed his leg.
Yeah.
And it's just, he tripped and fell and tore his tricep off. It's just, that's what happens. It isn't just the gym. So you got to be careful out there too. It can be dangerous, but being cognizant of your core positions and your back positions and building a nice, strong, firm core. And when I say a firm, resilient core for a power lifter, it's not just the rectus abdominis. It's not just the obliques. It's not just the posterior with the glutes, you know, the musculature, the lower the back, the lats. It's everything is one, 360 degrees. And the specialized exercises that people like Dr. McGill have put together, they didn't invent the exercises. They invented the three-pronged core attack. Posterior with the bird dog. It's a lot of glute, a lot of lats, T-spine. You got the lateral aspect of the core with the side plank, and then, of course, more anterior with the curl up. That's no flexion in the spine, very little head movement. It's just a modified curl up, basically. But those exercises, along with pristine spinal hygiene, is what we call it. Now, that's the fancy word for moving well. Mm-hmm. Pristine spinal hygiene, just giving my body time. We talked earlier about time, how important it is to repair. You stimulate, then you repair. You stimulate, you rest. You stimulate, you back off. Bodybuilding and powerlifting are way different.
Yes.
You can get away with train. If you have the right genetics, you can train muscles and get them big really quick. But the problem is the other tissue don't respond the same. They will tear and they will break. A bodybuilder, sure, you can do lat pull downs and bicep curls and tricep press downs three times a week if you want. Probably so, with minimal issues. But if you're benching multi-joint compound movements that are very stressful to the joints, the ball and sockets, you know, you're doing a bunch of bending with the core, you're going to wear your body out.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you remember Anthony Clark. He used to bench 600 pounds reverse grip. I used to train with them. Yeah. Anthony Clark. He's a good friend of mine from Houston, and he would coach me, and we'd compete together because we were about the same age in the teenage and junior ranks. But I remember he's the one who first taught me, because I deadlifted 800 pounds as a teenager, but I got up to 720 and I couldn't get past it. And he goes, Fred, you're deadlifting every week. He said, you know, I only bench every 10 days. I go, what?
Yeah.
I got to do Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You know what I mean? He goes, but does Scotty know what Monday, Wednesday, Friday is? No, it doesn't. So I started rotating, you know, my heavier lifts every 10, 11 days, according to my recovery, and not according to what was written down by somebody a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, that's brilliant. And a lot of people still do that 10-day split where they just rotate. And, you know, it isn't just Monday bench and Wednesday deadlift and Friday squat. It gives you a better recovery time. And as I've gotten older, I've reconsidered that methodology. And, you know, 10 to 20, I have some different ways of attacking it to squatting and deadlifting on the same day. Mm-hmm. And then giving yourself a full week to recover. Yeah. You also stagger your intensities on squat and deadlift, heavy deadlifts one day, light squat, vice versa the next week. So I definitely like that idea. And Anthony Clark is one of the pioneers. He was a monster. I wish I could have met him.
Oh, yeah. He's a great guy. Nice, quiet guy. You know, I mourn his loss all the time. But he was the first one when we were both kids. He was 19. I was 18. And we were at some meet, and he was the first one who came up to me. Why are you scared of the heavy weights? It doesn't matter what's on the bar. You just have to lift the middle of the bar.
Yeah, that's fun. That's funny.
He used to yell at me when we coached me. You're just lifting the skinny part, so don't worry about it. So what, he had a great mind game. Well, let's talk about that a little. Let's unpack that. What was your training like to that, you know, all-time world record 1,306 pounds? What did that look like now that you're a little older? Was it the same as you would have done 10 years ago or 20 years ago? I mean, what's your current strategies on yourself?
So this one was a little bit different because I had quite a interesting 2020. We had the babies in April, so yeah. They're 9 months now. And I got shingles shortly after, so I was a little sick just from the stress.
Yeah, yeah.
The baby screaming in the middle of the night. So I got shingles, and then, you know, I tweaked my pec, and then I got COVID. Then I tore my bicep off.
Oh, wow.
I had that repaired back in October, 2 days after the squat. I squatted that with a torn off bicep. That's why I didn't do the full meet.
Okay.
So I had a very interesting year. So that gives context for how my training was. It was different. I only squatted in my suit every other week.
Every other week.
And I really used the Squat Max MD, that belt squat you see me talking about.
Yep.
It really is a difference maker. And that's how I got the lion's share of the volume in my squat.
Okay.
I used the belt squat twice a week, once heavy, once light, and then only squatted in my suit every other week. So I tore my bicep 5 weeks out from the meet and then figured that, oh, okay, I can still squat, you know. So I tried a light week. And then I just squatted two more times until the meet and did all my heavy stuff on the belt squat. I think I did 800 pounds on the belt squat for sets of five.
Wow.
Which is true 800 pounds, like, directly underneath you.
Yeah.
And that helped my lockout so much that it was just enough. So, you know, I don't know if I would have squatted 1,300 if I was still training my other lifts, you know, because I had to back off of those the last month.
Okay.
Because it aided my recovery. But I definitely think I still would have been able to do 1265 or so, close to the all-time world record. You know, the all-time world record, regardless of class, was 1278. And so I broke the 1281 at 308 and the 308 and super heavyweight record. And then on the fourth, I retook it and broke it a second time. But I probably would have squatted 1265 if I was still benching and deadlifting. Benched around 850 and pulled around 8 and some change. So I would have been good for almost a mid 2900 total, but it's just how it goes. So my training is a lot more conservative these days, and I didn't handle, here's the key point. I'm glad I remember this. I didn't handle more than 1200 in the gym before the big squat. That was one of the things too. No reverse.
Wow.
Pans,
can you talk
no
about
overloads.
That a little bit, Brian? That's big. I want the listeners to hear that. Say that again and expound on that a little bit. That's big.
So with the torn bicep, you know, there's a lot of monkey wrenches in my planning. So I just did some experimentation. So I have a client, and I was the first coaching client, you know, back in October. I'm the first, I'm pretty sure, because there's only 10 or 11 people that ever squat over 1200. But my client in the same meet squatted over 1200. So I'm pretty sure a coach and a client have never squatted over 1200 in the same meet. But
no.
I coached him for that meet, and I had him do an extra heavy set 2 weeks out. I skipped it. He did 1265 with a reverse band after 1205 straight weight. I skipped the 1265 reverse band and opted for more rest. And I think my strategy was a little bit better. I hadn't felt on my back any more than 1205, and I took the 1306 on the fourth. So there was a big carryover, but that was part of my peaking. I didn't go too heavy in the gym.
Okay.
I didn't overtrain. I rested. I didn't cut weight. I walked in at 303 what I wore or what I weighed. I drank Cokes all week. I ate red meat, hamburgers, Chipotle, Greek yogurt, and orange juice is what I ate all week. So I was full. I was big. And I used my the power of the brain a little bit more. I believed, because my legs had gotten so strong on the belt squat, and I felt good, that even though I only squatted 1205 in the gym, I believed, because I've been doing this so long, I believed that anything that I picked up on that day with the perfect peak, with the perfect rest, no cut, that anything I could pick up out of the rack, I could squat.
Wow.
And I just went and did it. I don't have a secret for it. I just willed it into happening.
I think there's a key there for everyone who's listening, that, you know, you can get PRs in a meet. I know how hard it is for intermediate, even so advanced lifters, elite lifters, they have trouble getting PRs in the meet. They get on Instagram. Oh, I squatted 800. They get to the meet. They do 750. I go, what happened? And that rest and recovery, that deloading, and the mental game too. You've done all your preparation. You should be able to do 2, 3, 4, 5% more at the meet.
Yeah. That's the goal. Train to peak for the meet, not train for Instagram. And I mean, that's like a thing that's been said 100 times, but I used to think it a lot about 5 or 7, 6, 7 years ago. I'm like, I see where this is heading. People are going to stop competing.
Yep.
They're going to have virtual competitions, and that's what they literally do that stuff now.
Yep. They do.
Virtual, you know, and even I'm not going to bag on Half Thor, the guy that pulled the big 1100 deadlift, but he pulled the damn deadlift in his own gym. There's no one else competing. Come on. I mean, I get there was a pandemic. I get it all. But if I would have done that 1,300-pound squat in my garage,
mm-hmm.
It already caused enough waves. Imagine if I did that in my garage and say, this is the world record, guys, whether you like it or not. It's the biggest lift, even though it wasn't done in a, you know, in a competition setting. I was in charge of everything about the meet, like Thor was in his own gym. I mean, I don't know. Things have changed quite a bit. Let me just say that.
Everybody's a world champion in their own gym. And it's amazing when they have to get on the stage, you know, at a platform, at a big meet, it doesn't happen that way. I know with our training crew, Nemesis Powerlifting, we train for national and world meets. And I think we had 8 people at the WPC Worlds, and we had 6 people, and we came home with 8 gold medals, you know.
Wow.
Carryover. Because we don't train for little local meets, you know. We train for the big platform. You know, we actually practice. What if you get a bad lift off? What if the rack height isn't set right? You know, are your knees wrapped in time? We actually practice, you know, just like you would in football or any other sport, practice with those different variables once in a while, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I just thought of something. So I remember, I was pleasantly I was kind of blown away when I was watching the WPO semis, and the girls were lifting. The ladies were lifting on Thursday, right?
Yep.
There was about one point where I watched about a flight and a half of benchers, and like 3 benchers were missed. Like, yep. They hit everything. And I was like, man, a lot of gyms could take from what these girls are doing right now, because they all look like they touch in training. They all look like they're comfortable with being patient in the bottom. And I even said something when I was announcing them. I've never seen this many equipped lifters in a row look like they know how to bench.
Yeah.
They're prepared.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We practice. We make sure that we call them 2 board shirts, those shirts you can't touch. We make sure, like, usually someone will come in, oh, look at this shirt I got off from so-and-so, and they recommend it. And I'm like, can you touch in it? We don't care what you can 2 board. And that's
right.
2 boarding and you're injured, that's great. But that's a board shirt. And last time I looked, they don't use boards at meets.
You know? Right. What about if you tuck it under your shirt?
People have thought about that. And maybe that's what they're doing with these rubber band shirts. I don't.
What do you think of those rubber band shirts?
I don't know if they're a shirt. I mean, they're more like a slingshot, aren't they? One of our lifters, and I know some people that use them here in Minnesota, and it gives them 50 to 70 to 100 pounds more off of their shirt at bench.
I know.
But it's easy to use. I've already seen fractures. I've seen forearm fractures from them. Their bodies aren't ready for that, you know?
I'm worried about the lack of sleeve protection around the humerus, you know, the bottom of the humerus here.
Yeah.
The tricep and everything. I'm worried about that. We'll see some. We'll see some nasty tricep.
Yeah, there's going to be some horrific injuries from some of this stuff, and maybe that'll outlaw them. You know, I'm not going to badmouth anyone who wants to use them. That's fine, but it's too new and it's ramping up too quick. And I really don't think you can. I just watched someone who was benching 800 with a shirt do like a 950 with a band.
I saw that too.
And I'm like, your body can't jump 150 pounds. There's nowhere your radius and your humerus and, you know, an ulna can handle that. It would take years to build up that bone mass, not one day.
Yeah, you got to load slowly. That's why people end up breaking stuff. But it isn't just one time it was too much. You got too strong too quick, and your bones couldn't handle it. And I'm interested to see. And you mentioned it's basically a slingshot. It is with slingshot with like a stomach plate and sleeves.
Yeah. And so that'll be interesting to see what happens. So as we finish up here, I want to ask some, they can be personal questions. You don't have to divulge too much, but out of your whole career in powerlifting, reflect on the good, the bad, the ugly of some of your competitions. What was your good meet experiences, some of your best? What was some of your real ugly, you know, and what was some of your bad, you know? And this could be people you've trained with, some of your experience. Can you share a little bit?
Oh, I got I got a bunch of stories. So let me just start with the worst one, the worst as far as my performance. So 2007, I was coming off the biggest squat of all time. I broke Chuck Vogelpohl's record. He held it from 2002 to 2006, 1,025 to 220. No one saw that ever being broke for a long. It stood for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
2006 WPC Worlds, WPO semifinals. I broke it. And I went in 2007, Louis Pro-Am, the first one that he did again.
Okay.
It was in Dayton, Ohio. It was at a bingo hall. And I went in there and tried to cut way too much weight. And I was the current world record holder with 1,032.20. And in the back, warming up, I got pinned with 885.
Oh.
So I was done. Oh. I was done. And so wow. I told my handlers, I said, okay, go out there, lower my opener from 970 to 850. And so, of course, they went over and said, hey, drop Brian Carroll's opener, 970, 850. And they're like, did he break his effing leg? What is going on back there? So I bombed out of that meet. That was a low point, going from, you know, top of the world, mm-hmm. top three total, 220, 2376, only behind Frankel and Mash.
Oh, wow. Cohen,
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sucked. A terrible part is 2008 WPO semifinals, when two of my training partners before the squat disappeared for 3 hours and supposedly went to breakfast. I don't know. I'll never know what happened. But 50% of my help, when they knew that it was an important meet to me, disappeared. And when they showed up, when I was already squatting, they missed all my warm-ups, showed up when I was getting ready to take the platform. They had nothing to say other than we're here and we were gone, basically, is all they had to say. So that ended that friendship with those two people. One, Fred, one of these guys was a friend and training partner of over 13 years.
Wow.
So he knew how much it meant to me. I almost broke his face.
Wow.
Yeah, that's just disrespect. I paid for him to be there. I booked mm-hmm. them a hotel.
We do the same too to our handlers. We pay for the flights and the hotels. Yeah.
But they left the hotel. They left the hotel to go eat breakfast, even though the hotel had breakfast, and they disappeared for 3 hours. We called them and everything and nothing. So wow. That ended the relationship with those yep. two fellas. And you doing this, as long as I've been alive, you can understand that you don't do that.
No.
You don't do that. That's one of the worst things you can do.
Yep.
And back in the day a bit, if you would have done that at some places, you would have got beat down by people, because it's a show of disrespect.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that happened to you. That's horrible. I've heard similar stories like that. Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah. And so positive, I think I had one of the most fun in 2016. I had a really good shot at breaking the 242 all-time total record. At the time, it was 2695 by a Finnish guy. And it was at the U.S. Open, and it was for $5,000, and I just barely missed the total, but I still totaled 26.50-something, just going 6 for 9, and I won $5,000 there, and I came off kind of a bad Arnold showing, because I was trying to peak for two meets,
okay,
March and then April. That's kind of hard, right?
Yeah.
But I went there and hit, you know, the number two total again for like the eighth time all time at 242. And that was pretty fun, because I came off a bad showing at the Arnold. So there's three different circumstances: good, kind of bad, and then, you know, the real ugly one with the training partners. But it's been an interesting 22 years, and you know, I still have a lot, you know, left in the tank physically. Like physically, I feel good. I had the bicep surgery, but I've had flexion and extension. And I benched the other day, like 300 pounds for some reps. So I'm like easing back into like getting back into lifting, but I got a lot left physically, but mentally it just takes too much, because I dedicate a lot, as I'm sure you do and other people do. I dedicate a lot that takes away from making more money, being more available to my family, mm-hmm. My attitude, my focus. I'm very myopic with anything that I do. It's just like, you know, so I think that, you know, there's regrets I have with powerlifting. I should have done some better things. I should have hit bigger numbers. My best lifts add up to you know, well over 2,900 pounds, like for total, but my best total is 2,730. So that bothers me a little bit, but that's everyone, you know? So it's, I've learned a lot. I'm very grateful that I still walk around pain free. My back never bothers me. You know, I've never had any surgeries other than the bicep repair. I've been very fortunate with that. So I think I'm going to take the next little bit, work on getting my arm 100%, you know, losing some body fat, getting in shape, being with my daughters and my wife, and, you know, kind of taking it easy for a bit. You know, you look back and I have regrets that I didn't do better, but I'm real hard on myself, you know?
I think that that's common with every power lifter. You know, you always want a little more. It's always, I could have done better. I can do a little more. You know, that's what drives us. Why would you get under that kind of weight if you were satisfied, you know?
That's true. And it's hard to control that kind of discontent, you know what I mean? Because it can spill over to other parts of your life. You always want more. You want more, you know, more lifts, more muscle, more time training, better lifts. It's always, you know, more clients, more customers. Like yeah. It's...
Absolutely. So I want to ask a final question here, and I ask it of everyone I interview. If you were talking to a newbie, you know, even like my teenage daughters, or even an intermediate state level powerlifter, what's the best recommendation, one or two hints you would give them?
Well, I have a kid that's 19 that trains with me now here in Jacksonville, and he's actually on a D1 scholarship from Wisconsin to here to Jacksonville University. He plays lacrosse, and he's a really strong power lifter, and he's got a lot of potential. He's already pulling 650 or so at 19 at 198 and squatted 750. I mean, he's got like a lot of potential.
Yeah.
But he's hyperactive at someone, you know, 19. He's very mature for 19, but I tell him, and I'm mentoring him, take your time. There's no rush. You don't always have to go heavy. You've got all of your 20s to work on molding your strength. There's no rush. Don't take stupid supplements. You don't need those. Mm-hmm. Don't try to eat all you can all the time. You have plenty of time to gain weight, you know, eat right, gain weight, but don't think you have to eat 15 Big Macs a day because Louis said somewhere that, you know, you need to eat McDonald's or whatever. And it's not just picking on Louis, but that's like the old school mentality, right? Yep. Eat a bunch of fast food, get bigger, fill out weight classes. No, just take your time, do some meets at 198, and then naturally when you fill out, you'll go to 220, naturally fill out, go to 42. But there's no rush to just start eating and training super hard all the time. Build a good foundation. That's point number two. Build a good foundation. Don't be in a hurry.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, thank you for joining the podcast. Happy New Year to you, your wife, and the two kids. I know this is the fun age, believe it or not. You're not getting any sleep now, but this is the fun age. Pretty soon there'll be teenagers and you're going to have to start lifting again like I did to keep the boys off of out of there.
Yes. Well, hey,
I love it. I love it when the boyfriends come over and they go, "Oh, this is my dad." And I stand up and then they go, "Holy shit." And I go, "Yep. And let me give you a hug." And you know why I give you a hug instead of a handshake or fist bump? I want you to feel how big I am.
That's funny. Yes. I'm going to have to keep that in mind. I am enjoying every moment of it.
Yeah, it'll get better. Once they get potty trained, it'll get better. It's great. Well, thank you. And Brian, if somebody wants to contact you for coaching or anything, what's the best way for them to get your services or to get some help?
So my website is powerrackstrength.com. You can Google that and it'll take you right to it. Or if you want to directly email me, you can contact me on the site or directly email Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at power, P-O-W-E-R, rack, R-A-C-K, strength, strength.com. And you can check out, you know, some of my products. I got a lot of content on there from the last 7 years of riding. I got old content on Lead FTS and a lot of videos on YouTube that I'm going to start populating more. So that's really it. And I appreciate you having me on, Fred. And I'll probably see you in Florida later this year.
Yeah, I'll be down there in June for the Nationals. You going down there?
Where is that hosted?
I think it's going to be in Fort Lauderdale. The Claudia and Sean Knowles are going to run it.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I think we have meets in April, May, and June. So, yeah, we'll be there.
All right, sounds great. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless.